Bonjour. Thank you for your kind introduction and the invitation to allow us to present our work here. A long time ago, I studied one semester, actually, right around the corner here at the Sorbonne. But this was about 100 years ago. I'm afraid my French is too rusty now to talk to you in French. Please interrupt me at any point if I say something unintelligible to you, like snail. It's a little hard for me to know how to pitch what I am, how to present what I thought to present. So I would like to first see sort of hands. Who in the audience is in auditory research? Who is a scientist? Okay, there's sort of quite a number of people. So I will try to sketch a general context, but there will also be quite in-depth data slides that I will show, and that may be more difficult for some of you. Before I forget, let me acknowledge two collaborators. Tom was a PhD student in the lab. Phil Smith he's a professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, has been a longtime collaborator. So I will start with some context. I will show some old data. I will show some hypotheses, speculative things. And towards the end, I will show new data. And Tom and Phil were essential to get a very surprising result in these new data. Okay, so one of the, one of the attractive, sort of aesthetically attractive things about the auditory receptor organ is its shape. And as far as we know, functionally, the shape is totally, the snail shape is totally irrelevant, functionally, as far as we know. But the spiral shape somehow always evokes ideas about time. And somewhat ironically, I didn't put down a picture of a snail, escargot, but ironically, it has sort of this picture of being a slow thing, but it's by far the fastest receptor organ we have. And just as one example, the screen here is flickering at a rate of 50, 60 images per second, something like that. We don't see any flickering. If the rate of the flickering would be changed, increased, for instance, you would not notice. If these images were sound, and the sound was chopped up at a rate of 50 or 60 hertz, virtually your entire auditory system would be locking, would be following that rhythm of 50 or 60 hertz. You would have to increase it, the rhythm, by almost two orders of magnitude before the auditory organ would become too slow to follow these changes. So hearing is extremely fast. And it shows in many ways. It shows in the cochlea, but it also shows in the central nervous system. So the first thing I want to very quickly address is, why is this important? Why is the cochlea and the subsequent neural processing so fast? And in my mind, there are kind of two kinds of reasons. First of all, in a daily life, we are usually confronted with multiple sounds, multiple speakers, echoes, all kinds of environmental sounds. And these all sum acoustically. So your eardrum and the stapes, the inner ear bones and so forth, they all move just according to one waveform. So everything is summed into one waveform at the eardrum and further on. This waveform doesn't, so let's say you have here, these are figures from a paper by Sharma, you have two speakers, the sounds of the two speakers are summed, and at your eardrum, there are no colors here to distinguish which sound came from which speaker. So the ear and the nervous system have to somehow dissect that waveform to know which components came from which sound source. And there are two fundamental dimensions in which you can dissect the auditory signal. One was mentioned in the previous lecture, is frequency. So here we see what frequencies are present as a function of time for three sources. So there's a wind instrument, a hammer, a person's voice, all superimposed. First of all, by splitting the sound up in its composing frequencies, you gain a lot of information about what different sources are present. For instance, the frequencies, so for both for the wind instrument and the human voice, there are multiple harmonics, multiple frequencies that are integer multiples of a fundamental frequency. So you see these harmonic stacks, as they are called. You can see for the wind instrument, these frequencies are very steady, whereas for the human voice, there's much more dynamic in these frequencies. If you have a hammer striking a nail, for instance, a lot of frequencies are present very briefly at the same time. So you see that besides tracking frequencies, also tracking what is happening at an instant in time is very important. Okay, so for instance, components that start together, let's say frequencies here, this frequency band, for instance, does that belong to the human voice or does that belong to the wind instrument? Well, components that start together probably come from the same source. So components that are amplitude modulated, that are frequency modulated, that start together. These are all temporal aspects which are very important to group sounds, to segregate different frequency components and to assign them to different sound sources. So that's the first general reason why it's very important for the auditory system to be very fast. The second reason has to do with space. It has already been mentioned in the previous lecture. A very fundamental difference between hearing and the other sensory systems is how it handles space. This is a piece of skin. This is the retina of the eye. In those two major sensory systems, there is coding of space immediately on the receptor organ, on the skin or on the retina. So there's spatial information already at the very start, which is not true for the cochlea. So the cochlea does not have direct coding of space. We know from a long history of line of research that very important for space, especially in the horizontal dimension, left, right, are comparisons between the two ears, as mentioned in the previous lectures. So if I have a sound on my right ear, it will be a little more intense on the near ear than at the far ear because of shadowing, a shadowing effect of the head in between the ears. So that's the first cue. That is what we call intraoral level differences. This will come back in the next slide. And of course, also the sound will be a little earlier at one ear relative to the farther ear. So these are time differences. And so that's, again, a process that requires very, very faithful information on timing of the waveforms at the 2 years. Okay, so that's the two general reasons why I think speed is so important in hearing. So let me now take a step back to talk about the spatial aspects. This is mostly what I have been working on how binaural cues, binaural information is being analyzed in the nervous system. This is a slide which shows these binaural cues, these differences between the two ears. And again, there are these two kinds, differences in intensity or in sound level, and differences in time, ILDs and ITDs. Now, it has been known for a long time that these cues, they change reasonably monotonically as you go from the middle, the mid-plane, towards the side of the head. Okay, so the cues are zero right in front, right? So no intensity differences, no time differences right in front. And then as you move to the side, the time differences and the level differences will become larger. So here we have some values for these level differences. So they go up to about 20, 30 decibels for sounds at the side. It depends a little bit on the frequency, and I will come back to that. If you look at the timing cues, the timing cues are only several hundredths of microseconds. So this is for a cat. For a cat, it's like 300 or 400 microseconds maximally. For humans, it's a little bit less than 1 millisecond. So these time differences, and this has to do with the speed of sound, these time differences are amazingly small. And so humans can discriminate time differences of about 10 microseconds, which is just absolutely astounding if you know that the brain works with signals that are kind of slow. It's not like in chips, right? So our hardware in our head is kind of sluggish, but still we're able to discriminate these very small time differences between the ears. And that's one of the fascinations of working on this binaural sensitivity to ITDs. Okay, now also it has been known for a very long time, more than, you know, people have studied this for more than 100 years, that these two cues, ILDs and ITDs, operate over different frequency ranges. So as was mentioned in the previous lecture, at low frequencies, ITDs dominate, the time differences dominate. At high frequencies, the level differences dominate. And this, you know, this general finding is called the duplex theory. And this was already formulated by famous physicists in the 19th century, Rayleigh, Thomson, Ohm, and so forth. Okay, now this theory is mostly based on pure tones. Pure tones are a very special, very, in a way, artificial kind of sound. If you go to more complex tones, things get a little less clear, and I will return to that. So we actually can discriminate ITDs also at high frequencies, ILDs at low frequencies are also important. But by and large, you know, this still holds. ITDs dominate at low frequencies, ILDs at high frequencies. And so we can look in the brain, and that's one of the nice things on about working on this system. You know that to analyze these differences, you need a neural structure which gets input from both ears. So you immediately you know where to look anatomically, namely where information from the two ears comes together. This is a side view of the brainstem of a cat. The initial data I will be showing you, the older data, are obtained from cats. So to orient you, the tail is to the left, the nose is to the right. This is a side view. The cerebellum has been largely removed. This is the midbrain with the inferior colliculus. Here's the auditory nerve. The cochlea has been removed. And this is the cochlear nucleus. So this is the first synaptic site in the nervous system. The different parts to this cochlear nucleus. Here's the TB. This abbreviation will come back. TB stands for trapezoid body. Just an anatomical name. And it contains output fibers, axons, from cells in the antroventral cochlear nucleus. Now, if you make a section like this, tangential to the to the brain, you get this kind of view. All right. So here we have the left cochlea, the right auditory nerve on both sides, and there are a large number of nuclei in the middle, buried in the brainstem. Here you again see these fibers, the TB. So fibers from the cochlear nucleus go to the left and the right. And there's a large number of nuclei, and the major nuclei can be grouped into two circuits, which we can call the ITD pathway and the ILD pathway. And this is really kind of the textbook picture, you know, what you will see in general neuroscience textbooks. And the nice thing is that these two circuits seem to correspond with this duplex theory. So it seems like there are two circuits dedicated to the extraction, to the computation of these time differences and these level differences. Why is that? Well, the circuits have a different frequency bias. So this circuit is more biased towards low frequencies, this circuit towards high frequencies. They have a different binaural sensitivity. So if you look at cells in this nucleus, it's called the MSO, the medial superolive. If you look at cells here, they're very sensitive to timing differences. So if you just give a pure tone, low frequency pure tone to these cells, and you change the timing between the presentation at the two ears, you see that cells, the output of cells, the number of action potentials fluctuates as a function of ITD. In contrast, if you record from these cells, the LSO cells, their firing rate will depend on ILD. And I will get back to this quite extensively. They also have a different sign of binaural interaction. These cells are excited from the two ears, so if you give a tone to the ipsilateral ear on the right here or the contralateral ear, the cell will respond to these monaural tones because both of these inputs are excitatory. They will tend to make the cell fire more action potentials. Whereas these cells are so-called IE cells. The first letter stands for the effect of the, oh, there's something missing here. Stands for the effect of the contralateral ear. The second letter stands for the effect of the ipsilateral ear. So if you stimulate the contralateral ear, a tone here, these cells will be inhibited, and I will go into the reasons why that is. If you stimulate the ipsilateral ear, these cells will be excited. And so you get kind of this ILD sensitivity in these cells. And again, this is just a picture from a general textbook. This is very much the general consensus. Two circuits, one to compute ITDs, one to compute ILDs. Now, maybe a little bit paradoxical, even though my title is temporal processing, I will be mostly talking about this circuit, the ILD circuit. And what I will show is that this textbook picture is actually wrong, or at least it's incomplete, and that actually this circuit has an important role in computation of timing differences, just like here, for different kinds of sounds, but this is really also a temporal comparison circuit. Okay, so here's an overview. I will first state a problem with this sort of textbook view that I just gave you. I will then show older data where I followed up a hypothesis. I will then formulate a new hypothesis. This will be quite speculative. And then I will show new data, which gave us a very surprising result. And one of the reasons I picked this topic is not only because this is very new data, but I think it kind of illustrates, you know, how science works in a way, right? So we form hypotheses, we test them, and we find, if we're lucky, we find that the hypotheses are wrong, and we formulate new hypotheses, and we keep going like that. And the other thing, which will become clear at the end, is that sometimes concepts can just hang around for a very long time and turn out to be wrong. So let me go back to that textbook view of the ILD circuit. So the LSO, the lateral superolive, first of all, is sensitive to ILD. So how do we measure that? What do we mean by that? So we just present a steady sound at a constant intensity to the ipsilateral ear. That's the excitatory ear. This will make the cell fire a certain number of action potentials. Then we present the sound to the contralateral ear. And if we do that and we increase the intensity of that sound, we see that the rate of the cell decreases. Okay? So the cell is ILD sensitivity. The ILD changes as we increase the intensity to the contralateral ear. So here you see a couple of responses. It's from an old paper. These are classical studies, the people who first described this sensitivity. So if you have only a sound to the excitatory ear, the ipsilateral ear, you see that the cell generates a lot of action potentials. If you now start increasing the sound to the contralateral ear, the inhibitory ear, you see that the number of action potentials decreases. And so when the sound level is about equal in the two ears, there will be very little response left in these cells. Most cells need a little bit more intensity in the contralateral ear to shut off completely. And so this is really a very simple operation in a way. These cells are just weighing the the activation of the cochlea on one side versus the activation on the other side, right? So if the sound is on this side, the sound will be louder, will be more intense at this cochlea than at this cochlea. So if the sound is on this side, there will be more excitation than inhibition, and the cell will be responding. If the sound is on this side, it will be more intense on this for this ear than for that ear, and so you will have more inhibition than excitation, and the cell will just shut off. So it's a very simple process. Okay, a second classical property of these LSO cells is not just the ILD sensitivity, but their behavior, if you just give a simple tone to the excitatory ear, they show this chopping behavior. And chopping, you can think of like in a Chinese kitchen, right? When you cut with a knife, that's chopping. It's just an expression of the fact that these cells tend to give a very regular discharge. So this gives a probability of spiking, of emitting action potentials as a function of time if you give a tone. And you see, these are four different cells. You see that these cells tend to chop. That generates these peaks. And actually, chopping is a very... Most cells in the brain show chopping. If you, for instance, if you depolarize them. It's a very, very simple behavior. And it just comes about because cells are slow, because they tend to integrate. So let's say a cell gets tens or hundreds of inputs. It's not every time that an input is active that the cell will respond to it. So the cell will accumulate, integrate inputs, and if there's enough inputs active, it will generate a spike, and you know it will tend to do that at a regular kind of pace. Third property is, as I already mentioned, these LSO neurons are tuned mostly to high frequencies, so they can only, most of the LSO is really responding to higher frequencies above a few kilohertz. So these three properties kind of fit this idea that this circuit is really there to compare the intensity at the 2 ears. Why is that? Well, intensity is not an instantaneous quantity. So to measure, let's say if you have a sound level meter, you know, there are different settings. There's always some integration over time. So intensity is not an instantaneous quantity. You need some integration to measure intensity properly. And so that these cells are kind of slower kind of makes sense if you want to compare levels at the 2 ears. Also that they are high frequency makes sense because the ILD cues are most strong at high frequencies. And of course, the ILD sensitivity totally makes sense for this idea that they are ILD detectors. But there are problems. And so what are the problems? Well, if you look now at the inputs pathways, and so now I showed you this, now I'm kind of zooming in and putting some more names down. This is just one cell in the LSO. Let's first look at the excitatory input from the ipsilateral ear. So this is the cochlea, the auditory nerve. The auditory nerve ends with very strong terminals on the cell bodies of these cells. These are the so-called spherical Bushy cells. These cells are actually not very well characterized. The high-frequency Bushy cells are not. As far as we know, they tend to have thin axons, and they project to the distal dendrites of these LSO cells. But so, remarkably, they get these very large inputs, quite unusual, on their cell bodies. These are the so-called end bulbs of health. If you look at the other side, it starts, of course, again in the cochlea and the auditory nerve. Here again, we have, it's another kind of Bushy cells, the so-called globular Bushy cells. They also get very large inputs on their soma, strong terminals. These are the so-called modified end bulbs. They're a little smaller than the terminals here, modified end bulbs of health. Now, these cells, the globular Bushy cell, they are very specialized. So they have very thick axons, and very thick axons mean they conduct with a very fast speed. So they initiate action potentials which travel very fast across the midline and end with an enormous terminal, single terminal, on the cell body of this nucleus. This nucleus has a complicated name, MNTB, medial nucleus of the trapezoid body. It's quite an unusual nucleus. And these cells are glycinergic. They use a neurotransmitter which inhibits these cells. Now, so these are among the largest synapses in the entire brain. So very, very, very specialized structures. We also know that these inputs terminate on the cell body and the proximal dendrites of these LSO cells. Okay, so now these big terminals, high conduction speed here, slower conduction speed there, big terminals, these all suggest that time is important in this circuit. You know, big terminals are usually associated with speed, fidelity and speed. And so that is a puzzle. So why, this is just a picture of one of these terminals, it really grabs this cell like a hand almost. Why do we need speed here? You would think, well, to measure intensity, as I said, no, you don't need speed. The opposite, you need to integrate rather over time. So it's very unclear why you would need this. I mentioned this, so there are different features here of indications that timing somehow is important in this circuit. And one of the aspects is that clearly there's kind of a speeding up of the signal from the contralateral side relative to the ipsilateral side. And I will show data in a minute that show that indeed, even though this pathway is longer and there's an extra synapse here relative to here, signals arrive here almost at the same time. And again, that you can ask the question, why is that useful? Okay, this is actually a slide. You know, many people have shown this kind of result. This is from an older study of myself in the cat. So we find that if you record from cells in the LSO, that the time it takes for the signal, let's say for the sound to influence the cell, that time is about the same. It's about 4 milliseconds when you present sounds to this ear or to that ear. It's a little, on average, there's a lot of variability here, but on average, it's a little slower, but not much for the contralateral ear, only about 200 microseconds on average. Okay, so now what is the role of this calyx, this huge terminal here in the MNTB, and all these other temporal specializations? Why could it be there? And I'm not going to go over the entire list. Let me just point out some things. If you think about a neuron representing sound level, there are actually other cells that seem to be better candidates for relaying information to the LSO than these bushy cells. So there are other cells, so-called stellate cells and multipolar cells, that in a way perform better at representing the sound level at the ear. These are both cells that are a little slower, that are chopping and that are slower than these bushy cells. It has also been shown that if you make a lesion of the LSO, so if you destroy the nucleus, you actually still get ILD sensitivity at the level of the midbrain. So it seems that the LSO is not essential to get ILD sensitivity at the midbrain. If you look in birds also use these binaural cues, timing cues, and intensity cues. There is ILD sensitivity in the bird, for instance, at the level of the midbrain, which has been said is very similar to what you see in mammals, but there's nothing like a calyx in birds. So it sort of suggests, well, you can get perfectly nice ILD sensitivity without having these temporal specializations. So it suggests that this textbook view of this lateral superior olive, LSO, is maybe not wrong, maybe it's wrong, but at least it's incomplete. It doesn't explain why you need these big terminals, for instance, like the calyx. Okay, so when I was a postdoc still with Tom Yin, so I'll be showing some older data now, I thought, well, it makes sense to have this timing, these specializations, because we knew that you are actually sensitive to ITD cues at high frequencies. So if you just use pure tones, then you are completely deaf for ITDs at high frequencies. But if you use more natural signals, in more natural signals, the high frequency sounds are modulated in time. Let's say if you look at voices almost any natural sound, you will have these kind of amplitude fluctuations. And it was actually measured, mentioned in the previous lecture, this is what we call the envelope, right? So you can draw an envelope, a line connecting all the peaks here. And so we know that the nervous system can use these envelopes to compare the timing at the 2 ears, right? So we have a modulated, amplitude modulated sound now, a very simple form of modulated sound. We present that same sound to the 2 ears. And so what I thought is, well, if we now change the timing between the 2 ears, maybe the LSO cells will be sensitive to that. And maybe that's why we need all these timing features in that circuit. And the idea is actually really simple. I had recorded in a nerve, bushy cells and so forth, these different input stations, right? The inputs perhaps. I don't need to go into the details of this figure, but it just shows that these cells actually code this envelope very well, up to several kilohertz. You can see that cells will be locked, the spikes of cells will be locked to the envelope of these AM waveforms. And so if they do that, and if you have that IE interaction, so excitation from one side, inhibition from the other side, then ITD should come out, right? So you have moderated sound at one ear, at the other ear. If all these components in that circuit are following that envelope, as shown here, and as I knew they do, well, then if the two signals arrive at the same time, you will have inhibition at the same time as excitation, and the LSO cell will not be happy because, you know, it's excited, but it's inhibited at the same time. So the cell will not produce a big output. On the other hand, if you now change the timing between the two ears, then you will have excitation in between the peaks of inhibition, and then the cell will be happy. The cell will be firing a lot of action potential. And that's exactly what I found. So this is one example for one cell. Let's just look at this curve. This just shows the firing rate again, just how many action potential does a cell produce for these different ITDs of an AM stimulus. And you see that indeed there's nice ITD sensitivity. So the response of the cell depends on the timing relationship of the sounds to the two ears. So that's nice. But one thing you may already notice, well, these are pretty huge ITDs. As I mentioned, even in humans, we have big heads, so we have big time differences. Even for us, the biggest time difference is smaller than a millisecond. A millisecond is here. Okay, so this is now in a cat. For a cat, it's less than half a millisecond. So you see that the change in response of the cell for sort of the ITDs that the animal will experience in a natural environment, the change in rate is actually not all that big, but it's there. But the more severe problem is that if I now, this is for another cell, again, this ITD sensitivity, these kind of AM signals. So now I superimpose an ILD. So I don't only change the timing between the two ears, I also make one ear louder than the other ear. And you see that the effect of the ILD is much bigger than the effect of the ITD. So these are actually not very big ITDs. At these high frequencies, ITDs can be 20, 30 decibels. This is much smaller than that. And you see that the effect of the ITD, ILD, is much bigger on the firing rate than the effect of the ITD. So the conclusion is not that these cells are insensitive to ITD, but it just does not seem to make sense that you would have these huge specializations in this circuit. Again, you know, the calyx is one of the biggest synapses in the whole brain. It would be, it's not commensurate. So it's not, it doesn't make sense that you would have this huge specialization to get this kind of weak sensitivity. Now, there was one stimulus, and I had actually very little data on it. There's one stimulus where I did see quite steep dependency of the response on ITD, and that was to a very simple stimulus, namely clicks, so transient. So click is like just, you know, a single impulse. And I happen to have one neuron, and this will turn out to be important later, one neuron that didn't show the classical properties of LSO. So it was not a chopper, it did not give a sustained response. It didn't actually respond to the AM stimuli. It would only respond with a single spike when I gave a stimulus. And so there's not much I could do, and I thought, well, let's check ITDs for clicks. And it shows that this cell is actually very nicely sensitive to the ITDs of these clicks. Okay, so ITD is again just the time delay between identical stimuli to the two ears. And the curve is actually pretty simple to understand. So I give this stimulus 100 times. If there's a big ITD, so it means the click in one ear precedes the click in the other ear by a big amount, so either here or there, then you always get one spike, one action potential. So you get 100 action potentials because I repeat the stimulus 100 times. So, for instance, if at negative ITDs, that means that the ipsilateral ear is leading, so you first get excitation. The inhibition from the other side comes later and cannot inhibit the effect of that excitation. So you get a nice ITD, a nice response to that stimulus. Same if you make the inhibition lead, followed by excitation, you will also get that nice response. It's only when now the inhibition excitation overlap with each other that you get this suppression of the response, which results in very steep slopes. So these are very, you know, very big changes. So over a few hundred microseconds, you go from zero response to maximal response. So that was the only stimulus for which I obtained a very clear effect of ITD. But again, I did this, I had only, I don't remember, I had only like three cells or something in which I studied this. And that's sort of where it stopped. So let me just summarize here. I didn't go through everything here, but so I looked at I used different kinds of sounds in these allosol cells. I looked at pure tones. There's some sensitivity to low frequency pure tones, but it's very limited. I looked at these envelopes, these AM stimuli. Again, there is sensitivity, but it seems weak. So only for these transient, these clicks, did I get strong ITD effects. But that's sort of where it stopped, and then I went on to study other things. And one thing that dissatisfied me here is, well, transients, clicks are kind of a boring stimulus. You know, why would this be important? And so that's what I kept thinking of. And so in the next slides, we will build up a new hypothesis. Why would this be important to have sensitivity to ITDs of transient sounds, click-like sounds? One thing that is very clear within animals and across animals is that this LSO and also the MNTB with the inhibitory cells, these two nuclei within an animal, they're clearly biased to high frequencies. Also, if you look across animals, different species, then it's clear that there's also a clear trend that these nuclei are big in small animals, right? Like in mice, for instance, you have a big LSO, big MSO, whereas the other nucleus, the MSO, is small in these small animals. Now, these small animals, there's a general trend that small animals also hear higher frequencies. We are big animals, we are down here. We are big animals, we have a big MSO, and we have a small LSO and a small MNTB. MNTB, actually, for a long time, it was even controversial. Do humans even have an MNTB? So there's a clear gradient. And of course, humans, like ourselves, we are really low-frequency animals. So we really hear very well low frequencies. We all know the phenomenon that cats and dogs hear, you know, high frequencies much better than we do. And that's because that goes together with size. Big animals generally have low frequency hearing. So there is something about high frequencies, small animals, binaural hearing, and timing that it should be tied together. So what ties them together? And so one source of information I looked at is just acoustics. If you have a sound in free field, if I just have a loudspeaker here, then of course as the sound expands in free field, the intensity of the sound will decrease. And this is quantified by the so-called inverse square law. Okay, so in general, all frequencies, the sound level will decrease as you get away, as you have more distance from the sound source. Now, if you look at measurements, real measurements, let's say in nature, and this has mostly been done, well, by acousticians, but also by a lot of people interested in communication in birds and in insects. So there's a whole literature which, you know, mammalian physiologists don't look at a lot, but there's a whole literature on, you know, free field aspects of sound communication, particularly in birds and in insects. And so if you look at these studies, there's something which is called in these papers the excess attenuation. So if you record just from a sound source and you go away from it, the sound level will decrease. That's the inverse square law. But it will actually decrease more than you would expect from the inverse square law, and that is called excess attenuation. And this is particularly true as you go up in frequency. And this has, you know, there are a number of physical reasons. There's absorption by, you know, atmosphere, there's scattering, refraction, and so forth. So there's a whole bunch of physical reasons why sounds decrease more than you would think they should. Now, this is particularly true at high frequencies, that they decrease more than you would expect. And it's very much true at the ground level. So if you put the source on the ground level and you put a microphone on the ground level and you measure at different distances, then there's a very, very quick decay in the sound level of as you go away at the ground level. And this is, again, particularly true for high frequencies. Okay, so if you hear high frequencies and you live on the ground, and we have to think of small mammals now, small mammals tend to live on the ground. So if a small mammal on the ground hears high frequencies, it means there must be a source which is pretty close to that animal. Here are some examples of such measurements. So without, again, going to too much of the detail. So the reference here is 2 feet, so about this distance from the sound source. That's what we call 0 dB. If you now go away from that, from the sound source, you will see a decrease. So this is distance here. As you go away, you see that there's more and more attenuation, less and less sound level. This is just the inverse square law. Now, this is measured at low frequencies. If you measure at high frequencies, you see that there's a much more decrease at high frequencies than at these low frequencies. This is another way to show this here. Attenuation is plotted, so the decrease in sound level. The dotted line shows the inverse square law. So as you go away, you have a decrease in sound level. But you see at higher frequencies, what you get is much more attenuated than the prediction of the inverse square law. And so let's say you're a small animal and you have to detect faint sounds. Well, if you only go away by a couple of meters, the sound may become undetectable, because especially if it's high frequency sound, because of these physical processes that attenuate the sound level. Let me skip this. We'll come back to it here. So the next question is, well, what are then sources of high-frequency sounds? Not so much environmental. By environmental, I mean not caused by animals. So if you think of rain, wind, streaming water, these sorts of things, those sounds tend to be low frequency. No, there's some high frequencies in there, but they're dominated by low frequencies. So environmental sounds don't generate much high frequencies. So what generates high frequencies? Well, it's mostly animals, other animals. And in what way? Well, partly for communication. And some animals use that deliberately as a strategy. For instance, mouse pups, right? So a mouse pup wants to call the mom mouse, but without being heard by, you know, an owl that may be flying around, for instance. And so by using high frequencies, and living on the ground, the high-pitched sound of these mouse pups will only be heard at a close distance by the mother mouse. It's also well known for birds that they sometimes use high-frequency sounds to escape detection by predators. Okay, so these are deliberate sounds. But there's another class of sounds which actually is almost never talked about in, let's say, in hearing science, which are biological in origin, so they are caused by animals, but without the animals wanting to make sounds. And this is any time you move, any kind of motor activity is, whether you want it or not, is always accompanied by sounds. And these are called adventitious sounds. And so again, there's different physical processes why that is the case. So think if you walk in a forest, for instance, if you walk on little twigs, if you walk on dry leaves, or just on stones, you know, there's always sounds that you make just by moving. Now, if you look at the recording, and I must say there's not a whole lot of material to find in the literature, but if you look at recordings of such sounds, they tend to be impulsive. So it's like a series of clicks, and they tend to be dominated by high frequencies. So if an animal hears such sounds, the animal knows there's another animal in my neighborhood, and it must be close, right? Because the high frequencies attenuate, certainly if the animal is living on ground level. Here's an example, nice studies in Madagascar on lemurs. So lemurs are primitive primates. They're nocturnal, so they live at night, and they eat bugs. And so these are recordings from bugs, little bugs crawling on leaves. Okay, so with a closed microphone. And so this is a slow time scale. This is a zoom in here. So if you look, these are just milliseconds, right? If you look at the sounds made by these little bugs on the leaves, they tend to be these series of impulses. They're often called rustling sounds. And so these people showed that the lemurs detect those sounds. And because they live in forest, they can actually use their hearing to detect their prey. They want to eat these bugs. So they can use these rustling sounds to detect their prey. Other examples, sort of in the opposite sense, are mice. If you, in laboratory conditions, if you give mice a choice, let's say they have to get from place A to place B, and you give them two possibilities, two paths, and one path has leaves on it, and the other doesn't, then the mice will actually show the path without the leaves. You could think, well, the leaves, they can hide behind the leaves, not to be seen, but they will not go on the leaves. And the interpretation is, well, because they know that that causes these rustling sounds. And that's, for instance, what owls use to detect these crawling mice. Okay, so if you put all that together, we come to a hypothesis. So the sort of the picture I have in mind is that we evolved, mammals started as very small creatures, kind of like shrews, in a nocturnal environment. Mammals were the first, and still are, the only animals with high-frequency hearing, above several kilohertz. So high-frequency hearing is really a specialization that mammals developed. And what I kind of picture is that in these early mammals, which were nocturnal, so we know that the sort of the niche occupied by early mammals was nocturnal. So what I envisage is that these nocturnal animals used this high-frequency hearing to get about with their lives, and that means to detect things that they might want to eat, other animals, or to avoid things that want to eat them. And so that these adventitious sounds that are created by moving about, they need to be localized very quickly so that an animal can know, well, is it on my right? Is it on my left? If I'm a prey, then I want to run away from that sound. If I'm a predator, I want to run towards the sound. And so the idea is the following. We already looked at the ILD sensitivity. So we know these cells in LSO are ILD sensitive. Now, let's say you have now impulses, right? So you just have these clicks. You give two clicks, so you will cause excitatory postsynaptic potential from the excitatory ear and an inhibitory postsynaptic potential from the inhibitory ear. If there would be no specializations, and that's shown by the lower figure here, if there would be no specializations, you would get tuning like this. Why? Well, because it would take much longer, several milliseconds longer, for the contralateral ear to influence its cell than for the ipsilateral ear. So you would need, in order to really get overlapping in inhibition and excitation, you really need to present the signal first at the contralateral ear by several milliseconds earlier than to the ipsilateral ear. Okay, so you would get this kind of tuning. Now, this kind of tuning would not be very useful because the animal, this is ITD here, this is ITD. And as we said, the ITDs that an animal experiences, these are dictated by the distance between the two ears. And for small animals like mice, these are very tiny. So the animal, this kind of tuning is not really useful to the animal. So what I envisage is then the following, that by speeding up, by having the fast conducting axon, the big terminals and all that, you speed up the contralateral ear relative to the ipsilateral ear, and so you bring this tuning into a range which is useful to the animal. So that's the general idea. You have now ITD tuning, just using the same machinery, you've only added speed, you get this tuning, and that tuning is coherent with this tuning. So it's kind of the same code. It just means, well, when a cell The cell can be activated by an ILD favoring the ipsilateral ear, or it can be favored by an ITD favoring the ipsilateral ear. And so when a cell is active, let's say on the right side, it just indicates, well, there is something on my right. Whether the cell detects that by ILD or ITD doesn't really matter. The code is the same for these kind of two kinds of cues. Okay, so now I will get to the last part and show actual data that we obtained recently. Now this gets quite technical. I will go pretty fast over it. And you know, please ask me questions or stop me anytime if you want more explanation of this. Okay, so this is now the LSO. excuse me. This is now no longer in the cat, but in gerbil. Gerbil is a kind of a small rat, native from Mongolia. in the gerbil, the shape of the LSO is sort of like this. So we stretch out the nucleus here, you know, in a computer virtually. And so Tom Franken recorded from a number of cells with a difficult technique, namely patch clamping. So with this technique, you blindly sneak up to a cell, and if everything works out, you're actually able to record the intracellular signal, so the signals coming in and also the signals going out of the cell. Plus, if you're lucky, you can actually put a dye in the cell so you can actually see the cell afterwards and study its structure. So Tom labeled and recorded from a number of cells. And luckily, Phil Smith, you know, who we collaborate with, was in the lab. And he looked at that tissue in great detail. Now, it has been known for quite a long time that there are several cell types in this nucleus, in the LSO. And so Phil looked at the morphology of the cells, the placement of the cells, and also at the ultrastructure, at the electron microscopic features of these cells. And one thing he did is to look at the coverage by terminals of the cell bodies. And I don't need to go into details, but people had described five types of cells in the gerbil LSO. This is called principal cells and then a number of other cell types. The principal cells are shown up here, you know, for the ones that we labeled. And these are kind of the cells classically associated with this nucleus. So they're bipolar cells. So if you look at them, you have a cell soma, you have dendrites going both ways. But there are other cell types as well. They're a minority. If you dump tracer in the midbrain, in the folliculus, you look at the input from the LSO, then about 70 or 80% of the inputs are from these principal cells. That's why they are called principal cells. Okay, so, but there's also these other cell types. And it turned out that we labeled at least one example of all these other cell types, except a particular category of small cells. These are actually cells feeding back to the cochlea. So there's an efferent system projecting from the brainstem back to the cochlea. And this is one, there are two main systems, and this is one of these efferent systems. And these cells were apparently too small for us to record from. There's actually almost nothing known about these cells, so we're kind of sad that we didn't get recordings. But so we only got recordings from the cells that were colored in. Okay, so Phil then was able to classify these cells, and then we could look, well, are there any differences in the physiology of these different cell types? And we obtained very, very surprising results. So if you look just at spontaneous activity, so we don't give a sound, we just record from the cell intracellularly, look at what is happening to the membrane potential of the cell, we see that these principal cells have fast fluctuations in their membrane potentials. For comparison here, we have two traces of MSO cells. MSO cells are in this other circuit, doing time comparisons, they're known to be very fast cells. And LSO cells are almost as fast as these MSO cells, at least the principal cells. If you look at the non-principal cells, they're much slower cells. So this was a first surprise. Fast cells, slow cells, and there's ways to quantify this. We also noticed that these allosol cells, the principal cells, have small action potentials. These are just a bunch of action potentials for one cell. So you see that these are quite small compared to the action potentials of the non-principal cells. And people in the audience who are in physiology will recognize this. So this is something you also see in MSL neurons. MSL neurons also have very small action potentials. So these principal cells are really quite like MSL cells. And so using these, the size of the action potential, also using how fast the membrane is, we can we can plot all our data. And so there's quite clean separation between the non-principal cells and the principal cells. So we can separate those two populations. Now, the biggest surprise comes here. If you now look just at the responses to sound, then we see in the principal cells, if you just put on a pure tone, so a pure tone to the excitatory ear, what we were expecting is this chopping response, as I showed earlier. And the cell, none of the principal cells did that. They just give an onset response. They give one spike at the beginning of the sound. And sometimes, there will be another spike. So this is just the y-axis here is intensity. This is time. So we give tones of increasing intensity. And each dot just indicates the firing of one action potential. And you see that all of these principal cells show strong response at the onset, but not much response after that. By contrast, if you look at non-principal cells, they can also show these onset, similar onset responses, but they actually show this chopping behavior. Okay, so here you see the regularity, right? The tendency of these cells to fire a succession of spikes. So here you see the chopping behavior. Also, if we, because we have intracellular access, we can actually electrically manipulate the cell, we can depolarize the cell, we can hyperpolarize the cell. When you do this in the principal cells, they just, this is a response pattern which has been observed in many fast cells in the cochlear nucleus and elsewhere. So you just get a spike at the beginning of the depolarization. This is the response to sound of these same three cells. So the response you get by depolarizing the cell is very similar to the response to sound, just one spike at the onset. Whereas in the non-principal cells, you get sustained firing. Right, so you get as long as you depolarize the cell, or as long as you give sound to the cell will be discharging spikes. Same for inhibition. Inhibition is transient in principal cells and is sustained in non-principal cells. And if we now look at ILD sensitivity, it looks very different for principal cells and non-principal cells. Okay, so here we have in this panel, we have monaural responses. So these are, again, just tones. We give a high-frequency tone just to the ipsilateral, the excitatory ear. We get one spike at the beginning and then kind of steady depolarization, but no more spiking. If you give just the tone to the contralateral ear, you get an inhibitory postsynaptic potential and some sustained hyperpolarization. But pretty weak beyond the onset. If you combine now the tones to the two ears, and this is what is shown here. So here we vary ILD and show the recordings. So only at negative ILDs will you get an action potential, but it will be limited just to the onset of the stimulus. Whereas in non-principal cells, you will see firing throughout the stimulus. And if you go to positive ILDs, you will actually see sustained inhibition to the stimulus. So maybe to most people here, it will be no surprise. It will not be a shock, I would say. But so for more than 50 years, we have all thought that the LSO is an ILD nucleus where cells chop, where they give sustained responses when you give a sustained stimulus. What we're showing now is that it seems that these recordings are not exclusively, but are dominantly from these non-principal cells. So that actually the majority of the cells in this nucleus have not really been reported before. So our statement here is that the principal cells, so the bulk of the neurons in this nucleus, are sort of like MSL neurons. They're cells that are seemingly specialized for timing. They have fast membrane properties, they have small spikes, and they have onset responses. Then we wonder, well, many people have recorded in the LSO, and they've always reported these choppers, so why is that then? Well, there's an interesting twist to it, which is, I think, sort of interesting sociologically, in terms of the sociology of science, So Boudreau and Sukitani were the first people to record in the 70s from the LSO, and the first people to show the ILD sensitivity. And they made quite strong statements. They saw these cells with the onset responses, with phasic responses, and said, but these cells are bad, these are pathological. And so there was this general notion that you see in the literature that many people, myself included, have actually seen these cells with phasic response. But there was this general notion that if you see too many of them, you're a bad physiologist. And so many people use this chopping criterion as a criterion to say, okay, I'm recording from LSO. And so in a review, Boudreau and Sukitani even say that they changed their methods in order not to see these cells with these onset responses, because they thought it was a sign of bad, damaged cells. Okay, so I already showed this graph, and I mentioned, well, this was actually one of these cells with a transient response. So the next step, and this is really why we were doing these experiments, is now to test, well, do these cells really show this sharp ITD tuning? And that's the last part. I will be quickly go over this pretty quickly. So if you just give this is now two clicks. If you just give a click to the ipsilateral ear, you get a nice depolarization and spiking of the cell. If you give a click to the inhibitory contralateral ear, you see a nice hyperpolarization. And notice the time scale here. So that IPSP, that inhibition, lasts for many milliseconds. Okay? If you combine the two clicks, in this particular cell, there will be no response. So the spiking will be suppressed. So now the question is, we give clicks to the two ears and we change the timing between the two ears. And indeed, this is just one cell, we see nice ITD sensitivity, more or less like I was showing in the cat before. And I don't want to go over the details here, but what is surprising here, if you look at the time scale, the width, these are very, very steep slopes. So in a matter of just, of 100 or a few hundred microseconds, you go from a full response to no response. So you have very steep slopes created by this interaction between the ipsi and the contralateral ear. So this width here is less than a millisecond, right? So this is 1 millisecond, this is 0, so it's less than a millisecond. So even though the signals coming in are kind of slow, the sensitivity of the cell is very, very sharp. Okay, here's another picture of that. So here we align a number of responses to the stimulus to the excitatory ear, the ipsilateral ear. So that's this timing. And again, we change the ITD, and you see that you have a reliable response to the ipsilateral ear. If inhibition leads, okay, you will still get a response. It's only over a narrow range of ITDs that the inhibition will actually be able to suppress the spiking of the cell. And then here it lags again. And so again, remember the IPSP is long, it's several milliseconds, but still its result, it's only able to suppress the excitation over a very narrow time window, which is somewhat surprising. Okay, this is the last data slide, and then I will summarize. Another thing is, we would say, as far as we are now, well, this supports the hypothesis that the LSO, at least the textbook picture, maybe it wasn't wrong, but it was at least incomplete. So we think the important function of the LSO is not so much to detect ILDs, but to detect ITDs of these high-frequency transient stimuli. And the complementary question then is, well, the nucleus that is typically thought of as the ITD nucleus, the MSO, so that's really consists of cells that are very sensitive to timing differences. What do they do to these timing differences? And it turns out for high frequency clicks, They're absolutely bad. They are very poor. Now, there's some effects in some cells, but in generally, if you look at the output rate of these cells as a function of ITD, there's not a lot changing, whereas in the LSL cells, there are steep slopes. Okay, so let me summarize here. So I hope convinced you that there were reasons to suspect that there was something about timing that was important in this nucleus. We surprisingly found that the principal cells, so the bulk of the neurons, are showing onset responses, not these chopper responses, so implying that most of the existing literature is really looking at the minority of the population. And the reasons for that probably have to do with the small spikes. So these principal cells have small spikes, as I mentioned, so you have to go pretty close with your electrode to pick up these spikes, and you're probably more likely to damage the cell. LSO, but not MSO neurons, show robust ITD sensitivity to these click-like stimuli. And so given that these cells do that, it makes now much more sense why you would have that big helix and these other specializations in that circuit. And so the proposal is that this has really evolved for animals to detect these adventitious sounds produced by animals at close range. All right, and I want to thank again my collaborators, Tom and Phil, and thank you for your attention.